Hello and welcome, everyone, to the 17th episode of Nations of Charlemagne. Gosh, there have been so many and so many more to come. Now, today's conversation is going to be, I've labored away at the title. Obviously, the convention, the popular convention, we to call this the Counter-Reformation. And I'll get into the issues revolving that revolving roll, sorry, I apologize, revolving around that in a minute. Also, I really want to point out to people watching that when the lecture is over, I will be answering questions. So please, if you have a question, perhaps consider it as you're listening to the lecture, and then wait until the end, and then you can ask me, because essentially I'm captive here. You can ask me anything you want about this topic. So please do at the end of the conversation just wait and send me a chat when the lecture is over. So obviously I'm going to start out by talking about the Council of Trent, because obviously this is going to be the central focus for the conversation. Now, what do I mean by the Tridentine era? Tridentine from Tridentum, meaning Trent, the Council of Trent. The importance of Trent cannot be overstated, and that it set the temper of Catholicism for the next 400 years until the Second Vatican Council in the 1960s. In the years following the Council, we see the publication of the Roman Catechism, now known as the Catechism of the Council of Trent. For those who aren't Catholic, a catechism is an authoritative theological manual for the purposes of religious education. In this case, in the light of the Protestant Reformation and as a redress to the ignorance and corruption within the Catholic Church, which was acknowledged by the Council. Moreover, we see the codification of the Tridentine Mass between 1566 and 70, the central mode of Catholic worship until various revisions in the 1950s and 60s, and then the codification of the Novus Ordo Missae, or the Mass of Paul VI in 1970, which abandoned Latin for the vernacular languages. The Tridentine Mass was until recently accepted as the extraordinary mode of Mass until its very recent suppression with the Motu Proprio Traditionis Custodes. Another ecumenical council of the Church would not be held for 300 years until Vatican II, which, rather than reform significant elements of Trent, was focused on the trends of Marian Immaculacy and Ultramontanism, the movement in the 19th century defending the powers of the Pope, which had, of course, been established by the Council of Trent. By the 1590s, a Tridentine authoritative Latin Bible, the Vulgate, had been produced. Politically, the Tridentine system provided the bedrock of Catholic auctoritas, authority, legitimacy, what have you, by the 17th century, though it was a difficult inception in France and even Spain. However, countries like Poland readily accepted the reforms of the Council. This only began to diminish with the turn of essentially the Enlightenment and the path that many monarchs took, such as Joseph II. Catholic monarchs towards enlightened despotism and the I do apologize for my cough and religious tolerance in the 18th century. And then the complete overhaul and destruction of religious society with the French Revolution. Now, when it comes to Tridentine era, I need to emphasize this is not going to be a theological summary. I don't have the credentials or the expertise to make a theological analysis of the Tridentine Council, the Council of Trent. However, this is going to be a episode dedicated essentially to how this affected Italy in particular. We're going to be going over the generalities about the Council, but mainly this subject is going to be focusing on Italy, the artistic, political, cultural, economic reverberations that we see in the wake of the council throughout the 1540s all the way until the late 17th century. Now, getting on to Counter-Reformation, I've included a an image of the Spanish Inquisition. By the look of their outfits, this is the 17th century. It should be noted that this is, as often the case, a much later historiographical invention. The Gegenreformation, the German invention, which came in, gosh, I think it was around 1840, to characterize this period. And there's a very good introduction by Eric Cochran, who is the set reading for Monday's discussion. And I'll just read it to essentially give you a feel of the implications of this word. Ever since the middle of the 18th century, the Italian Counter-Reformation has found little sympathy among historians on either side of the Alps. It has been dismissed as a back eddy in the main current of European civilization, the current that is, which runs from the Renaissance through the Protestant Reformation, or perhaps the Radical Reformation or Revolution, to the Enlightenment and to the constitutional democracy period. It has been associated with economic depression, with political servitude, and particularly in Francesco De Santis's History of the Italian Literature, with moral degeneration. It has been held responsible for a major break in the progress of liberty between the ages of Machiavelli and Vico. Of course, Giambattista Vico is one of the leading lights in Italian. He's essentially a counter-Enlightenment thinker before the beginning of the Enlightenment. So he was really reacting to Cartesianism, and of course, he's renowned for his new science and as a philosopher and a thinker on the topic of history, he's invaluable. It has been blamed for whatever art historians find to be incomprehensible or morbid in the late Mannerist and early Baroque painting. In Italy, it has been the victim of a preference among historians for the 14th and 15th century or for the 19th and 20th centuries. In English-speaking countries, it has been the victim of lingering Anglocentrism and anti-papalism, and it is simply omitted or mentioned only marginally in most general surveys of the period. Even the term counter-reformation is loaded. It implies a conservative reaction against a progressive innovation. Of course, this is what was essentially considered when it was coined in the 19th century to describe the more or less forceful reconversion of formerly Protestant areas of Germany. Etymologically, it implies negation in all languages, and in the last 30 years, it has acquired an additional pejorative connotation in French and Italian by its similarity to the Marxist term counter-revolution. Since Vatican Council II, since the Second Vatican Council, moreover, it has come to be associated with a whole epoch in the history of the Church, one which the pontificate of John the 23rd was supposed to have brought to a close. And of course, this is of major consequence to any Catholics today, as I'm sure you're aware. Now, when coming up with an alternative, obviously I've landed on Tridentine Era, which I'll explain now. Often the term Catholic Reformation is used as an alternative to counter-reformation. Why I balk at the usage of the Catholic Reformation is both theological from my own limited understanding and historical. To Catholics, the notion of a Reformation, Protestant Reformation, is a misnomer. Rather, it is a revolution, technically a schism, confirmed by the Council of Trent. An interpretation of the Reformation, which includes all of Christianity in the sense, removes the centrality of the Church as the bride of Christ, which of course to a Catholic is nonsense. The notion of a Catholic Reformation has two issues, namely that the Church is always reforming or in need of reform. So why highlight this area in particular as the era of Catholic reform? Preceding Trent, we encounter countless reform efforts, namely the Gregorian reform, monastic reform, the reforms of the various monastic orders thereafter, the emergence of St. Francis of Assisi, then Francis of Paola and the Minim Friars, the Theatines of the later Pope Paul IV, etc. The notion of a Catholic reform relating to Trent itself is self-evident and needn't be the basis of our formulation, and to cast it principally as such is again makes it again a reaction against, or worse, casting the Catholic Reformation in likeness of the Reformation. And of course, the Reformation, I mean the Protestant Reformation. Catholic revival or restoration, therefore, makes more sense in the literal stemming of Protestant growth and in some instances reversal. However, Tridentine reform or era rightly places the emphasis on the centrality of Trent as a pivotal moment. And I think if you recall back to my blurb at the beginning, it really should be emphasized how much of a significant ecumenical council the Council of Trent was. So leading us up to here, again, I'm assuming that a lot of people wouldn't have seen all the previous videos in the survey in this series. So, a quick lead up to this. There were various Catholic reform movements in the aftermath of the Papal Schism, the Avignon Schism, where at the beginning of the 15th century there were as many as three popes. Here we have the Council of Florence and the Council of Basel, which had a conciliarist. And what conciliarism means is Catholic conciliarists believe that the General Council, or the ecumenical council, like, say, for example, Vatican II, has primacy over the Pope. And therefore, it is dependent on the Catholic religion to repeatedly hold various councils in order to obtain that legitimacy. And of course, that was the intention set by the earlier council, convened by the Emperor Sigismund, which ended the three-way schism. But the Council of Florence itself, divided over the conciliarists and the people supporting the Pope, in the end, the Pope, this would have been Nicholas V, won out, and we have the beginning of the series of Renaissance popes. And from there, all the way up until the First Lateran Council, convened during the pontificate of Julius II, and continuing on through from Leo X, we see a strong affirmation of papal supremacy and a rejection of the conciliarism of the previous councils at the beginning of the 15th century. However, in the same year, 1517, we of course see the emergence of the Wittenberg Declaration by Martin Luther, and the beginning of the Protestant Reformation. In 1521, we see the Diet at Worms, which places the ban by the Emperor Charles V on Luther, who at the time is protected by the Elector of Saxony. At this time, we also see this major cataclysm between Charles V, or the Holy Roman Emperor, who was also the ruler of Burgundy, the ruler of southern Italy, and the King of Spain. And of course, he is the Holy Roman Emperor in addition. And he is in conflict with the French. He wins a great battle in 1525, the Battle of Pavia, albeit King Francis is captured at that battle. He escapes, and then he agitates the League of Cognac, and this precipitates a series of events which leads to the sack of Rome. Essentially, between 1527 and 1534, the papacy, the Papal States, is at its lowest point. The Reformation is spreading like wildfire in Germany. We're going to see now the beginning of the Genevan Reformation, the Calvinist Reformation, which, as I argued in my lecture on the French Wars of Religion, can be very much seen within the context of the French Reformation, essentially. And of course, remember that John Calvin was French and educated in France, and came out of the humanist, proto-Protestants, which were very active under the patronage of King Francis I. So it seems remarkable within this context that the papacy and the Catholic religion undergoes such a dramatic revival. As of course I mentioned on my lecture, Charles V, which I'll advise that you do all watch because it's very important. With the notion of a very powerful Catholic secular ruler, who was also the Emperor Charles V, who controlled so many vast territories across so much of Europe, and then of course expanding into the New World, we have this idea that the Emperor should be responsible for resolving the Reformation, because it's principally within the Holy Roman Empire that this is happening. And accompanying that, we have figures such as the Marchese di Gattinara, who, among others, is advocating for the Ghibelline, i.e., the pro-imperial ideal, and this idea of a universal monarchy. And in order to undermine papal power to prop up the emperor, conciliarism, which had been, essentially, killed off by the First Lateran Council, is now making a comeback, which we discuss more in the discussion associated with that if you want more detail on this. But in any event, it seems very unlikely, because the Pope is essentially being undermined by the greatest Catholic prince. At the same time, it seems that Charles V will potentially resolve the Reformation without needing to adhere to the Pope, other than nominally as the head of the Catholic Church in spiritual matters. And at the same time, we have this major conflict raging across Europe involving the Turks. The Turks by now have taken Belgrade, they have taken Budapest, they have defeated and virtually destroyed the nation of Hungary at the Battle of Mohács. So now it comes to the unlikely hero of the papacy, Alessandro Farnese, who was elected as Paul III unanimously in 1534. The most unlikely reformer, the cardinal from the petticoat, on account of the fact that he was the brother of Giulia Farnese, the favourite mistress of the infamous Rodrigo Borgia, Alexander VI. He had fathered four children and promoted two grandsons as cardinals. And yet he revived, revived the ethic of Roman reform. And he is essentially the great reformer, the one who is able to convoke the Council of Trent against all odds. In the wake of the sack of Rome, he's partly responsible for the reconstruction of Rome as the, and the prime example of this being the fabulous Palazzo Farnese. He was also a dynast in the traditional sense of the Renaissance popes. So he built up and restored the fortunes of the Farnese clan. His crowning achievement in that regard was establishing the Farnese as the hereditary dukes of Parma, which they ruled all the way up until the 18th century. In the face of the rivalry between Francis and Charles, the Protestant ascent in northern Germany and the expansionism of the Ottoman Suleiman the Magnificent, there was now ultimately the necessity of holding a council. Now, it's important to understand that prior to this, especially during the papacy of the Medici Pope, the second one, Clement VII, that there had been a great anxiety about convening a council, simply because the assumption was that the emperor would take it over and use it as an attempt to promote conciliarism. Indeed, the emperor had already attempted various colloquies or speaking venues within the empire in order to try and resolve the various religious issues. These were proving completely pointless at this point. No progress was being made, and we're seeing the creation of the Schmalkaldic League against Charles V. So very much on the papal initiative and not the initiative of the emperor, Paul begins the progress towards reform and the summoning of a council. In 1536, Paul summons a church commission composed of Reginald Pole. Reginald Pole is an interesting character. He was a cousin of Henry VIII. He was the son of the Blessed Margaret Pole, who was executed by Henry VIII for her association, I believe, with a holy virgin who was prophesied the doom. It's recalled quite a lot in the Walpole novels. And Gian Pietro Carafa, the later Paul IV, a member of the anti-heretical Theatine order, which had only been recently established. To the horror of Paul, the Catholic Commission, which had been convened by Paul and Carafa, laid the blame for the Reformation on the sale of indulgences, benefices, and all manner of simony, and of course simony is the selling off essentially of church possessions, on the popes, on this Renaissance papacy. But despite this, despite the papacy being blamed by the Catholics themselves for the Reformation in many senses, Paul continued to encourage reform. And at this moment was encouraging the cleaning up of brothels within the papal states in Rome under the guidance of one of the three great saints of the Tridentine era, Philip Neri. In 1545, after the failure of various colloquies convened under Charles V, as mentioned, and these, again, it's important to note, are meant to include all Christians, including Lutherans. This is a major issue regarding the council as to whether it is going to be a Catholic council or whether it is going to be a universal council, a council of all, you know, Western Christians, obviously not including Orthodox. An ecumenical council was convened at Trent in Italian imperial territory. And what I mean by that is that Trent is now part of Italy today, but it was then part of the Tyrol. It was part of the bishopric of Trent, which was adjacent to the Habsburg lands and would basically become the Habsburg lands. It seemed at the beginning that the whole affair was going to be a disaster. Only a single cardinal turned up at the beginning, along with some 35 bishops. However, the council, over the next 18 years, over its three sessions, would come to be attended by 270 bishops, overwhelmingly Italian. There were barely any Germans present, and there was often not a French contingent because of the ongoing conflict between the emperor and Francis during the Italian Wars. Of course, this is all set in the midst of the Italian Wars, that epic struggle between the houses of Habsburg and Valois. In this sense, the council is resoundingly Roman and, again, acting in defiance of the emperor, that it's an Italian council convened under the auspices of the Pope. The notion of an ecumenical council for the whole of Christianity was thus rejected. Instead, the council provided the basis for the renewal of discipline and spiritual life in the church, halting the Protestant tide and eventually re-Catholicizing parts of Europe. What is notable is the English influence on the council, namely Reginald Pole and the posthumous influence of St. John Fisher, who of course had been executed alongside St. Thomas More a couple of decades before, or rather a decade before. In 1549, Pole died, leading to the adjournment of the council. The papal candidacy of the English Reginald Pole was thwarted by the overwhelming Italian influence over the curia. Pope Adrian III, the Netherlander, between the Medici popes, was the only non-Italian to hold the papacy all the way up until the Polish John Paul II in 1978. Den Molte, now Julius III, was another paradox in the sense of being the last of the Renaissance popes, renowned for his gluttony, nepotism, and lavish excess, both fiscal and sexual, epitomized by his various homosexual affairs. And yet he was an active promoter of the Jesuits and ensured the continuation of the council, and in keeping with the English influence there, joyfully received Queen Mary of England back into the Catholic fold. The council was then closed prematurely when Tyrol was approached by a Protestant Saxon army under the Elector Maurice after the great rout of Charles V. Julius's short papacy was followed by Marcellus II and then by Caraffa in 1555 as Paul IV. Paul IV, perhaps the most severe of all the popes of the 16th century, including Julius II, as you'll recall from the Italian Wars episode, was an ardent defender of papal prerogatives at the expense of the emperor, whose convocation at Augsburg, which recognized Lutheranism in the empire, was seen as a betrayal. To this end, with the ascent of Philip II of Spain, Paul readily sided with the French in the final stages of the Italian Wars. He was loathed, however, by the Roman populace for his reformist zeal, hampered in part by his over-reliance on his corrupt cardinal nephews, until he ultimately expelled them. His popularity in Rome was such that with the news of his death, the headquarters of the then Roman Inquisition was stormed while his statue was decapitated and the head thrown into the Tiber. His body was hastily buried in order to avoid a similar desecration of the corpse. Pius IV, of an altogether different character, finally reassembled and concluded the third and final session of the council. These were the immediate results of the council. Now, the emperor had previously pronounced the ban on Luther at Worms in 1521, as mentioned, refuted the so-called Confession of Augsburg after the 1530 Diet of Augsburg, effectively the Lutheran document of faith, and this was done through a refutation called the Confutatio. The final chance for any Protestant involvement in the council ended with Maurice's march on Tyrol, which was universally considered a hostile overture to the council, which resulted in the premature ending of the second session. It should be noted that many Protestants did consider joining the council. Quite a few nearly made the journey there, but it was really Maurice's intervention which prevented this being in any way a universal council of all of Christendom, even though in all likelihood the Protestant representation there would have been token at best. It should be noted that the Protestants refused essentially to acknowledge for the most part any council that was convened in Italy. Moreover, they believed that the Pope was the Antichrist. So with essentially principles such as those, it was virtually impossible to come to any agreement with the Catholic Church. When the Third Council was convened, the Catholic Church, under papal auspices, finally condemned Protestantism formally, nearly 50 years after Luther's 95 points were declared in Worms. Aspects such as the supremacy of the scriptures and soli fide, by faith alone, were rejected out of hand. Church and scripture possessed authority, which the church, as the ultimate interpreter of scripture, could therefore declare what was correct and what was incorrect in terms of interpretation. Much of the council's business dealt with disciplining the clergy, reforming benefices, i.e. church rewards for various services, often bishoprics or the red caps of cardinals, often if you wanted to bribe the papacy, giving them vast amounts of money could return you a cardinal's cap in the height of the Renaissance popes. the sale of indulgences, and of course the proper education of the clergy. The reforming zeal against pilgrimages, relics, the veneration of saints, and Mary the Mother of God in particular, were not only rebuffed, however, but their practice was reaffirmed, save for abuses such as idolatry. Although the Latin Council of 1517 had rejected conciliarism, De Gattinara and the other Ghibelline Caesarea papists advocated in pursuing their goals of universal monarchy under Charles V. With the military and religious defeat of Charles, the goals seemed very distant, and indeed unreliable, especially with the permanent division of the House of Habsburg. Though the Spanish branch of the family remained formidable, indeed hegemonic in Italy under Philip II, Charles's son and heir, the popes had narrowly avoided having their theological authority supplanted by the emperor. Trent was an affirmation of papal independence and supremacy, which is all the more remarkable when you consider the terrible position that the papacy was in only 30 years before. Essentially, to put this in perspective, after the sack of Rome, Clement VII was basically a refugee within his own country. So getting on now to, and do send super chats, the Jesuits and Catholic mysticism. Paul III received one Ignatius Loyola, a Navarran, along with his Spanish comrades from their self-declared Society of Jesus. And of course, he is the author of Spiritual Exercises, which is still read. In 1540, the Pope gave the Society his official support. Unlike the other religious orders, Franciscan, Dominicans, what have you, the Jesuits were defined by their unconditional obedience to the papacy and their zeal in conversions. Such dedication is found in the formula of the Jesuits. Whoever desires to serve as a soldier of God beneath the banner of the cross in our society, which we desire to be designated by the name of Jesus, and to serve the Lord alone and the Church, his spouse, under the Roman Pontiff, the Vicar of Christ on earth, should, after a solemn vow of perpetual chastity, poverty, and obedience, keep what follows in mind. He is a member of a society founded chiefly for the purpose to strive especially for the defence and propagation of the faith and for the progress of souls in Christian life and doctrine, by means of public preaching, lectures, and other such ministration whatsoever of the word of God, and further, by means of retreats, the education of children, unlettered persons in Christianity, and the spiritual consolation of Christ's faithful through hearing confessions and administering the other sacraments. Moreover, he should show himself ready to reconcile the estranged, compassionately assist and serve those who are in prisons or hospitals, and indeed to perform any other works of charity according to what seem expedient for the glory of God and the common good. And of course, a little addition of my own. Ecclesiae militantis triumphi, the church militant triumphant. Now, Ignatius is significant because he was a soldier. It was very unlikely that he was going to enter religious life, but he is a gruff soldier, a Navarran soldier, and then it's all the more remarkable he didn't go one of many other ways. After the apocryphal idea, essentially, is that after a near mortal wound, he rededicates his life to papal service. He enters into religious education. I believe he attends the University of Paris, which is all the more remarkable, considering he was attending. This would have been in the 1520s and the 1530s, at a time when the Proto-Reformation movement in France was really getting ahead. You know, he's arriving there at the time of the placards, and then of course the subsequent crackdown on the Proto-Calvinists. And of course, this is when John Calvin flees France and goes over to Switzerland. And of course, you know, one of the first things he does is he goes to the Holy Land to preach there. And as is so often the case with the Jesuits, he is reprimanded by the Christians already there, believing that his zeal is going to get them killed by the Sultan. And of course, the Jesuits are renowned for their zealousness and their conversions, you know, during this time and, you know, for a very long time until relatively recently. I think the remarkable aspect of the Jesuits in this period is that their dedication to the popes enables this resacralization of the image and the piety of the popes after what you can be considered, you know, the impiety and nihilism that have been brought in effect by the Renaissance popes. And again, this was even promoted by other popes. such as Julius II in his Vendetta Against the Borgias, which I went into in length in that episode. In this respect, the Jesuits served as the foot soldiers of the Tridentine reform. Accompanying the Jesuits were the aforementioned Theatines, focusing on clerical discipline. The Ursulines, the Order of St. Ursula, focusing on the education of women, the Descaled Carmelites, etc., of St. Teresa of Avila. The Jesuits in particular carried out missionary work in the Spanish Empire and in the New World and Asia, of course, as I mentioned, reaching as far as Japan. With the rededication of the veneration of the saints, the Catholic mystics focuses on prayer and inner conversion of God, inner conversion to God's will. The greatest of all the Spanish mystics was John of the Cross, a Carmelite friar, although both John and Teresa of Avila were split from the order and formed the Descaled Carmelites. Perhaps the greatest display of the Tridentine Reform's emphasis on mysticism and a new art is found in Bernini's Ecstasy of St. Teresa, a dramatic and even sensual portrayal of Teresa's spiritually altered state. There was a brief revival of Thomism after St. Thomas of Aquinas and medieval scholasticism under Tolerus and Fonsenca after the ascendancy of humanism in the early 16th century that in part had facilitated the emergence of Protestantism. Finally, we must consider that refostering of the dedication to Mary and the method of Catholic contemplation via the centrality of the rosary. Although the prayer knot had existed prior, Pope St. Pius V established the custom of the rosary, a set of prayers and preponderances on the holy mysteries, the joyful, the sorrowful, and the glorious. Perhaps the zenith of this worship is demonstrated in the various allegories of the Battle of Lepanto, attributed to Mary's intercession and the encouraged use of the rosary by the then Pope Pius V. And of course, the victory at Lepanto was then consecrated to Our Lady as the feast day of Our Lady of the Rosary. Now, getting to the political aspects, having moved on from the religious aspects, from 1556 to 1559, we witnessed the close of the Italian Wars and the abdication of Charles V. The intervention of Pope Pius IV, Henry II of France, and the Lutheran princes of Germany had robbed the Habsburgs of total victory. Nevertheless, in Italy, the Spanish under Philip II von Habsburg were foremost, if not absolute, in their power. From 1559 to 1701, the end of the Italian Wars until the Spanish War of Succession, the borders of the Italian principalities would remain virtually unchanged. In Lombardy, the state of the Presidi, along the Tuscan coast, Naples, Sardinia, and Sicily, the Spanish rule through viceroys and the local nobility. In the centre, the Papal States enter an uneasy relationship with Philip, who still clung to the Ghibelline pretensions of his father and resented the idea that he, the champion of Catholicism, should be a mere temporal actor for the popes, not only in Italy, but in all the possessions of the Spanish monarchy, being the Free Duchy of Burgundy, the French Comte, the Greater Netherlands, because, of course, at this point, the Netherlands hasn't been sundered, Spain, and later Portugal. The Council of Trent ensured that from the early onset of his reign, the papacy assumed the responsibility of church leadership, relatively lacking in the Renaissance popes, appointing nuncios and apostolic visitors with papal instructions, now handy with Tridentine decrees. This obviously reduced the autonomy of the regional churches, and with it their corresponding loyalty to the sovereign over the Pope. Uniformity, the enforcement of Tridentine regulations throughout Catholic Europe, was arguably one of Trent's greatest achievements. As local Catholic reformers invariably welcomed the regulations, rather than this amounting to a pure imposition from Rome. Ironically, now the Holy See was more truly Catholic, and by that I mean universal. It was less focused on Italy, despite the overwhelming Italian representation in the council. Italian clerics who would have remained in Italy became church ambassadors for the re-Catholicization efforts across the world and not just Europe. The papacy and Philip were at first united on an Italian foreign policy, more so than with Charles V, where it was agreed that the Ottomans were the primary threat. A pan-Italian effort led to the victory of Lepanto and the eternal fame of the presiding Pope St. Pius V. Genoa and Venice were key to that victory. The maritime wealth of Genoa declined in the 17th century, and both Genoa and Venice were in constant conflict with the Ottomans thereafter, losing Cyprus shortly after Lepanto. Venice entered a period of long decline around the year 1600. In 1606, Venice was placed under the last interdict when the Great Council passed a law restricting the land rights of the church. In a demonstration of the limitations and, you can say, the exceptional nature of the Venetian Republic, Paul V had attempted to place an interdict in a similar manner to Julius II a century earlier, and yet the clergy demonstrated loyalty to the Venetian Republic over the Pope and continued practicing their various ministries. And again, when you place a nation under an interdict, you're essentially saying that no sacraments whatsoever can be practiced because there is no authority, there is no secular authority which is recognized by the Pope. And essentially, this is a means often, once placing a nation under an interdict or placing a particular ruler or sovereign under an interdict, is to rein them in and prevent, you know, excommunication and, you know, a sentence to hell. This particular brand of deeply rooted Venetian anti-clericalism was unique while remaining Catholic. Thanks to the intercession of Henry IV of France, the interdict was finally lifted. In 1669, after a 24 year of the siege, which is quite incredible to consider, Venice lost Crete, the largest possession of the Stato di Mar, to the Ottomans. Now, coming to other Italian nations, Savoy, though allied with Spain, was confirmed in its territory by the peace treaty which ended the Italian Wars. However, soon after, it abandoned its Spanish alliance now that the threat from France and the invasion was no longer imminent, and became neutral. Joining Spain at Lepanto was Cosimo de' Medici of Tuscany. Florence had briefly become a republic again during the reign of Savonarola. The Medicis entered ascendancy again under Pope Leo X and Clement VII. Clement VII in particular ruled over both Florence and the Papal States as Pope until he conferred a Florentine dukedom on Alessandro de' Medici, ending the pseudo-republican system and establishing two centuries of hereditary rule for the Medici. He was succeeded by Cosimo of the junior branch of the family, Catherine de' Medici of France, who of course mentioned extensively on the French Wars of Religion episode, was now the only surviving member of the senior branch of the famous family originating from Cosimo and Lorenzo il Magnifico. Tuscany was in an awkward position in that it was created as a fief of the Holy Roman Empire under Charles V. Then the imperial crown went to the Austrian branch of the family and not the Spanish branch, meaning Cosimo was a vassal of Austria and not Spain. To complicate matters further, St. Pius V elevated Cosimo to Grand Duke, placing him under the vassalage of both the Pope and the Emperor, all the while surrounded by the possessions of Spain. Cosimo finally ended the Florentine-Sienese rivalry by conquering Siena and establishing a navy at Elba. At the time of his death, Tuscany was a major and wealthy power in its own right, ennobled further when the Habsburgs, the Austrian Habsburgs, married into the Grand Ducal family. I find it all the more remarkable, again, playing into this idea that English historiography in particular leaves out this entire period, that I'm sure virtually most of the people in my audience, albeit I credit my audience as being far more educated than most, has probably never heard of the Medicis post Lorenzo the Magnificent, unless, of course, you've been watching the various episodes on this channel. Fernando II de' Medici, of course, I believe he was the great-grandson or the grandson of Cosimo, is remembered as the patron of Galileo Galilei, who will be talked about right at the end of the stream. As for Philip, Naples became his second great holding outside of Castile after the Union of Utrecht fractured the Netherlands. And again, for more context on that, watch the Dutch Revolt stream. With the evolving scope of Spain's wars after 1579 until 1648, from the 80 Years' War to the Spanish Armada to the Franco-Spanish War, coalescing with the 30 Years' War, Naples, Sicily, etc., bore the costs of various Spanish failings. During the late reign of Philip, his role of champion of Catholicism was challenged by the energetic and ambitious Sixtus V. Sixtus V continued the Tridentine reform program further, producing the 16 Vulgate and pronouncing in his bull, Ephrenetam, without restraint, that the use of contraception and committing abortions at any period of fetal development incurred excommunication. Prior to this, abortion was considered a great sin, yet theologians were in debt to Aristotle's concept that the human soul was not fully realized at conception, rather it matured as the unborn child did, leading to ambiguity over the precise moment a human soul is formed, and therefore Sixtus V establishes clearly that the human soul is created at the point of conception. In the manner of Julius II, Sixtus V was a great builder, the new St. Peter's being well underway to completion, while he exerted the temporal power of the papacy within the papal states, a strong and centralized state of the Pope being effectively able to resist the dominion of Philip II of Spain. Other than defending papal prerogatives, Sixtus's zealous anti-Protestant campaign against Henry IV of France, a Huguenot, and Elizabeth I of England coincided with Philip of Spain's goals as well. While Sixtus was alive, Henry could never be accepted by Catholics as king, and therefore leaving France potentially perpetually paralysed and more susceptible to Philip's desire to place his own daughter on the throne, or, better yet, leave France in a perpetual state of anarchy, and therefore Spain can retain its domination over Europe. However, Sixtus died in 1590, and Clement VIII's reconciliation with Henry and acknowledgement of his conversion unmade Philip's French strategy. When Philip II died, the crown of Castile was bankrupt, Spain vulnerable to the ascent of France. Over the next 50 years, the power of the Spanish Empire would wane considerably. So building on all the previous lectures, discussions, what have you, we're really now talking about the period of the decline of the Spanish monarchy. We're not entering total collapse yet at this point. Even Spain is still a formidable power, arguably right up until the Peninsular War, the Napoleonic Wars in 1808, 1809, etc. But for now, Spain is having its, you know, essentially, Spain starts under Charles V as having the potential, or rather the Spanish monarchy, again, emphasize the House of Burgundy from the House of Austria, the House of Habsburgs, the Spanish monarchy. Again, just referring to it, the Spanish Empire is a bit of a misnomer, as we'll explain as we go further into this. But the monarchy of Philip II, the monarchy of Charles V, really did have the potential, again, to supplant the Pope potentially as the leader of Christendom and exercise real temporal authority, had, you know, France been able to be effectively subdued, and had the Protestant Reformation be defeated and in favor of the Emperor Charles V and King Philip II. If anything, what we see during the reign of Philip II is we're seeing the idea of universal monarchy being defeated, essentially. And of course, with Trent, with the reassumption of papal powers vis-a-vis various temporal monarchs, this is, you know, confirmed. And we'll get into this, I believe, when we have our discussion on Tommaso Campanella. Now, here we have a rather controversial point for me, which is the so-called crisis of the 17th century. And I'll get into what the implications of that statement are as we go along this. Now, after an economic boom in the early 16th century, famine appeared in Italy in the 1580s and persisted throughout the 1590s. New waves of plague struck northern Italy and Tuscany in 1630 and 31, and southern Italy, Lazio and Genoa in 1656 to 1657. And with, you know, huge population losses, we're talking between, you know, 1/4 of the population. The large cities such as Milan, North, Naples and Genoa lost as much as half of their population. In addition to war in Northern Europe after 1680, we see the 30 Years' War, which is going to be the topic of next week's discussion. And we further see, you know, general wars between the Ottomans and the Safavid Iranians, or rather the Sublime State of Iran. And all of this is disrupting the export markets for the mercantile powers within Italy. Moreover, we essentially have from 1559 until 1628, we have an unparalleled period of peace under the Spanish hegemony, or the Spanish spectre. And it should be noted that that is an even longer period than was confirmed by the period of equilibrium, confirmed after the Treaty of Lodi, which was the brainchild of the original Cosimo de' Medici and Francesco Sforza and Nicholas V, Pope Nicholas V in 1454. And this lasts until 1494, and the invasion of what Savonarola would call Gladius Mundi, Charles VIII, over pressing his claims over Naples. So it's a remarkable period of peace, but it's brought to an end once the conflict between Spain and France really escalates. We enter into the period of Cardinal Richelieu in France, which we'll talk about later in a subsequent episode. And the French are essentially at war with the Spanish until 1659, long after the Treaty of Westphalia. and or rather the Peace of Westphalia is agreed upon, which ends the 30 Years' War, one of the most devastating conflicts in European history. Both agricultural production and urban industries entered into a crisis from roughly about 1611 onwards and reached a low point in around 1650. Nobles during this period are often described as decadent and debt-ridden, while grain prices continued to fall throughout the 17th century. In the north, intensive agriculture supported the numerous large cities, but overexpansion onto unproductive land resulted in soil depletion, and the loss of credit pushed the region to the limits of what the population could support. In the cities, wool manufacturing fell and all but disappeared, save for, you know, we're talking textiles in general, save for silk production. Now, this is very important. When we're talking about the earlier Italian Renaissance, we're talking really, you know, the 14th century, the 15th century, the developments of Italian banking in particular, which were later emulated by the Dutch, who had really now come to supplant the Italians. Commercial and banking activities are now constricted. Italy is no longer the center of banking. Really, this has now moved. It originally moved to Antwerp, and now it has moved to Amsterdam. We're seeing the inception of the Dutch Golden Age during the around about the period of the 1630s until the 1660s, or really, you know, the 1670s. In addition to that, there is opposition to any technological or organizational change from the Italian guilds. Taxes are high due to the wars. There is high labor costs, and there is a lack of economic flexibility to deal with these constant crises, famines, etc. The only sort of exception to this was in Lombardy, where we see the putting out system, which transferred urban industries to the countryside. As Spain declined too, it should be noted, it dragged its Italian possessions down with it, and revolts broke out in Palermo, of course, the major city in Sicily, and Naples in 1647. The uprising spread to the countryside and established a republic that sought French protection and assumed the character of an open rebellion against Spain and the various lords associated with Spain. Internal dissension and the arrival of the Spanish brought an end to this revolt by 1648. And it should be noted, within the context of the Spanish Empire, that this is not unique to Italy. There is a coinciding rebellion in Catalonia, I think around between the years 1643 and 1648, but someone may correct me on that. So these sort of rebellions are happening throughout the Spanish Empire, but there are particular revolts that break out in 1647 to 1648. And here we're seeing the, you know, the serious sort of undermining of Catholic authority, Spanish authority, and we'll see that also with Campanella. Now, getting to the historiography, one figure looms very large over this, and that is Benedetto Croce. And Benedetto Croce is a fascinating figure in that he doesn't really belong to any discipline. He's noted as a great theorist, a philosopher, a political activist, particularly against Mussolini and fascism. And of course, he is then later sort of foisted onto the post Second World War Italian Republic as you know, one of its great defenders and defender of democracy. Yet at the same time, his conception of liberty is very much anti-egalitarian. It doesn't quite cross over into what, you know, we would know from the various sort of Austrian economist thinkers. And of course, you know, he is very influential in terms of both influencing the left and the right. I mean, in many ways, Croce is an influence for Giovanni Gentile, one of the principal thinkers of fascism, and at the same time, Antonio Gramsci, and then other thinkers such as R.G. Collingwood. So Croce is a very complex a character. Nevertheless, he does not excel when coming to his criticism of the period, which corresponds to both the political situation and the cultural situation, as we'll get into. And he calls this period La Crisi Italiana, the Italian crisis. Croce is particularly interested in the problem of Italian decadence in the 17th century. Benedetto Croce wrote about it in his works, Spain in the Italian Life, during the Rinascenza, which roughly is another iteration, I believe, of the Renaissance, and the history of the Kingdom of Naples. He was, of course, a Neapolitan by birth, albeit there is a Croce family, I believe, which is a noble family in Genoa, to make things a little bit more confusing. And likewise, in terms of what I talk about the 17th century, you notice I've used 1559 to 71, a little lesson in historical periodization. Often you'll encounter things such as the short 20th century or the long 19th century. The long 19th century, for example, would include 1789 or going up to 1914. Other iterations we have, the long 18th century, beginning with possibly, say, for example, 1601, set sorry 1701, and going all the way up to 1815 with the final defeat of Napoleon. In this case, I'm following along with Croce's periodization, situating this within the end, essentially, of the Italian Wars in 1559 and the beginning of the Spanish Succession conflict, which really, removes a lot of, the previously established order which had been established during this period in Italy. But the Spanish Succession War will be, for another discussion. Croce considers that Italian regression should be attributed to Spanish bad government in Italy. However, there are possible causes that the decadence within Croce's worldview could be attributed to Italy itself. The truth is to be found in another direction, that is, in recognizing that Italy and Spain were both at the time countries in decline, a decadence that embraced a decadence. If Italy had been, as it was no longer, rich and industrious, it would have easily shaken the dominance of the Spanish spectre, as did the Netherlands. And of course, Croce is interesting again, vehement anti-fascist, but also proud Italian nationalist. And of course, he's also a major influence on Umberto Eco, who is another interesting and paradoxical figure. According to another historian, Fanfani, the problem of our economic and cultural decadence by that Italian dates back to the 16th century, where Italy began to suffer from the price revolution. It is quite well known that the ruling classes of the Italian economy during the 16th century passed from industry and trade to security loans and land investments. In other words, they are transformed from mobile income categories to fixed income categories, from commodity owners whose estimate is constantly growing as a result of the general increase in prices to owners of movable and immovable capital if rented, who at a fixed maturity will give a predetermined income whose purchasing power is in the meantime reduced. And this compounds with another interesting aspect. Who is it? I believe it's Candelero, which talks about this process of re-feudalization, which is essentially that, among other things, we see the moving of economic wealth outside the Mediterranean basin and towards the Atlantic. This was confirmed with the arrival of the Spanish Empire and the Spanish Empire's increasing dependency on the vast bullion supplies from the New World, and especially the silver out of Mount Potosi in, is it Bolivia? Peru. Anyway, and of course, then the Atlantic is going to be the principal theatre of the later Dutch expansion, essentially. What this process we're talking about here, refeudalization, is obviously there is, an assumption within with the various Italian republics of the late 15th century, early 16th century, that there was very much a bourgeoisie contingent, a banking contingent, a mercantile contingent that was in the ascendancy, essentially. But what we see during this time is the emergence of nobility, or rather the re-emergence of nobility, relying more on landed wealth as opposed to, again, we're talking about capital assets. So all of this again is used as potential cause for the Italian decline. Villari contributed to Croce's rather severe pronouncement on a corrupt Spain and a corrupt Italy, highlighting the responsibilities of the Spanish bad government as the first cause of the decadence in Italy. Spanish politics considered Italy a land of fiscal robbery and military servitude for the sole purpose of the Christian West struggle against the Muslim Turk. Now, there's a lot to unpack there. Obviously, there is an element of that which is true. Many Italians were participating, for example, in the Spanish conflicts against the Netherlands and, of course, the Spanish conflicts against the English and the French. However, the conflict against the Ottomans wasn't an Italian struggle, which a Spanish struggle which the Italians have been impressed into. That's utter nonsense. As we see with Lepanto, one of the great successes of Lepanto is that what we're seeing is that all of the Italian powers, all of the maritime Italian powers, even the Grand Duchy of Tuscany, are participating in a shared foreign policy, despite having different elements of power, albeit Spain is the most powerful factor in all of this. I think it's fair to say that until the French begin to, you know, rear their heads again with the rise of the Bourbon dynasty, that Italy, under the Spanish, and as we discussed with Sixtus V, had more or less a shared foreign policy and a shared interest against constant raids by the Ottomans against Italian merchant ships, against the Ottomans attacking Cyprus, the Ottomans attacking Crete, and of course the Ottomans attacking the Dalmatian possessions of the Venetian Republic. So the idea that this was a Spanish struggle is utter nonsense. In fact, the Italian struggle against the Ottomans in far and away predates the emergence of King Ferdinand and his the Aragonese possessions and the conquest of the Kingdom of Naples. Now, going back to this idea of a general crisis of the 17th century, I'm sure those observers of you out in the audience will know that this is also known as the general crisis of the 17th century, when we see, the 30 Years' War, the Fronde Rebellion, the English Civil War, or what I prefer, the War of the Three Kingdoms, various epidemics, agrarian crises, for example. This more or less characterized as a great malaise of, European society. And of course, this is this idea of the crisis of the 17th century is taken, I believe, from the original Italian application by Benedetto Croce, and taken by the probably the most famous English Marxist historian, Eric Hobsbawm, to try and apply to how in some way represent some obstacles for developing a traditional capitalist system within the traditional sort of Marxist view of seeing the economic progression of systems. However, interestingly enough, we have figures such as Fernand Braudel, who of course is renowned for his study of Mediterranean civilization during the reign of Philip II, who again focuses on the economic decadence of the great Italian commercial cities, and very much emphasizes that the decline of the Mediterranean is the shift of traffic away from the Mediterranean Ocean towards the, you really say at the beginning, the ascent of globalism with the arrival of the Dutch. Then, of course, we have Hugh Trevor Roper's idea of court and country, which I think we'll get into more on the 30 Years' War stream as more relevant. So, again, talking Benedetto Croce, tracing the Crocean attack on this period, there is the continuation of that, which is his famous Eta Barocca, on the Baroque. Trent was significant in that it made specific pronouncements of the nature of Catholic art itself. Often, as we have seen, council interventions in art occurred during the various iconoclasms of the Orthodox Byzantine Dark Ages. Of course, this is part of Orthodoxy, Autocracy, Nationality series. A lot of the episode, the Byzantine Dark Ages, was dedicated to the councils dealing with iconoclasm and then rebuffing iconoclasm. And yet seldom has this ever been the case with Western Christendom, post-schism, the Great Schism being in 1054. In particular, the Council of Trent wanted to de-emphasize anything that could be considered profane or pornographic, nudity and, any sort of such implied excesses as a result of the Renaissance, and that any images placed in an ecclesiastical setting were subject to censure, even before the Roman Inquisition, as was the case with Paolo Veronese's Last Supper was considered obscene, so much so that he was actually sent before the Roman Inquisition, and it was demanded that he had to alter his painting to be more reverential, and ultimately he ended up changing the subject. Medieval art was de-emphasized, as were motifs considered explicitly pagan. Images were expected to have solid scriptural foundations. Now, the occurring art movement already was mannerism, which had persisted since the 1520s. And prior to the Council of Trent, there was also the Venetian school, which was developing its own independent style. What evaded the council requirements for the most part became the proto-Baroque and Baroque artworks of Caravaggio, Carracci, and the sculpture Bernini. This is the ecstasy of St. Teresa I was referencing earlier, who delivered treatments of a vast array of biblical subjects from the Assumption of Mary, which became a very common theme for Tridentine era Baroque artists, to the ecstasy of St. Teresa. Now, this is interesting again because we're seeing the development of Marianology. The Assumption of Mary replaces much common earlier depictions of the death of Mary. Toward the middle of the 17th century, this art form was picked up and promoted by Jesuits and Franciscans, reaching as far as Peru. The same approach was taken to music. Gregorian chants were meant to conform to new standards set in 1614. The emphasis was on musical styles that emphasized and deepened the appreciation of the new revised mass, a task undertaken by prelates such as Charles Borromeo. What is more remarkable is that the creativity spawned within the standards of the post-Renaissance, as opposed to being merely propaganda. It's quite remarkable considering the Croccian pushback against this reform. Now, I have here an aspect of an article which I cut for the required reading, Mary Lavin's Encountering the Counter-Reformation. And I think I'll just read this because it really is rather sensational in proving my point. Decadence, opulence, excess, clutter, sculptures that are life-sized, over-life-sized, lifelike, over-lifelike, complete with wigs, eyelashes, and tears, paintings that flaunt the Catholic doctrines, purgatory, the saints, transubstantiation, good works, and deliberately aggressive, asking for a fight manner, a crudely propagandistic, competitive phase of Catholicism, propped up, it might appear, as such by marble pillars and gilded statuary, as by pious simplicity of the Catholic reformers had once invoked. For many, regardless of their confessional allegiances, the material and visual outpourings of Baroque Catholicism presented its very worst side. Much argued about by art historians, it is an aspect of the devotional objects. By contrast, Janelle, author of the 1963 study, The Catholic Reformation, devoted a chapter to art and music in which he expressly lamented how the course of the 17th century, restraint and severity, the proper characteristics of Catholic art, were supplanted by a worldlier character, and the earlier simplicity of Tridentine art was lost beneath Baroque ornamentation. The most famous critique of such ornamentation came out from the push and pull of confessional history and was penned in 1935 by the Italian historian and theorist Benedetto Croce in his essay on the Baroque. For Croce and those whom he cites, Baroque signified bad taste, a sort of artistic ugliness, and that was how the painting, sculpture, building, and literature of the 17th and 18th centuries could be characterized. He despised the false dramatic liveliness of Baroque paintings and sculptures and pronounced that whereas other forms of the beautiful are sometimes arresting, exciting, disquieting, the Baroque, for all its agitation and surface warmth, ends by producing the effect of coldness, and for all the multitude of images which it brings on the scene and combined together of emptiness. In an earlier essay of 1928 on the moral life of the 17th century Italy, Croce cast his scorn more explicitly onto the Catholic reforming church, bemoaning its externalism, the privileging of ceremonial worship over charity, the reification of orthodoxy over understanding, all of which produced a morality of bigotry and orthodox decadence. Croce's vehement disdain for the excesses of Baroque Catholicism was born of contemporary concerns. At a time when the fascists looked back fondly on the Counter-Reformation as a golden age of discipline and authority, Croce responded by portraying the same period as intellectually and morbidly arid. And this is what I find, you know, rather remarkable. The single most striking feature of the recent historiography, you know, admitting this, of the Counter-Reformation is its commitment to taking devotion and its multiple manifestations seriously, however bizarre, unappealing, or ugly they might be. Well, of course, anyone who takes history seriously realizes that one has to enter into one's subject sympathetically, neither as hagiography or the desire simply to disprove or dismantle. And obviously, you know, the art style is not to everyone's taste. And Benedetto Croce is very much sort of revered as for his aesthetics. But I find this remarkable that the attitude taken is almost entirely propagandistic when, as I've elucidated, this form of art was actually created within the very sort of tight restrictions and almost at their expense. And often All of these works, you know, Caravaggio in particular, would encounter some form of clerical censorship. And this image I have of Bernini's Saint Teresa, which is really at the height of the Baroque movement, this was constructed in 1651. There's a remarkable sort of sensuality to it. Again, talking about that prohibition against the pornographic, there is a slight element that one can interpret from that in terms of the intensity of the work. So I find this notion that all of this simply represents a form of Catholic bigotry, because of course this isn't just a admonishment of the art; it's an admonishment of the entire period and the effort of the Catholic Counter-Reformation. Now, I'm going to come to the most controversial and probably the most remembered part of the Tridentine era. Of course, this is the persecution of Galileo. And I want to relay this back to the Spanish Inquisition, which had existed since 1478, created under the auspices of their most Catholic majesties, Isabella and Ferdinand. And this, of course, principally targeted Moriscos, Muslims who had, converted but were essentially seen as crypto Muslims. Muranos, again, the same treatment for nominally converted Jews, and of course heretics. And of course, this extended to Granada after the capture of Granada in 1492. And again, this is a very important point to make. Despite Spanish rule in Italy, the Inquisition was not uniform in its possessions. Ferdinand had established the Inquisition in Sicily and Sardinia, which were then part of his Aragonese inheritance, but not in his conquest state of Naples. Many Muranos have fled to Antwerp, which became part of the monarchy, but as part of the Netherlands. But that part never had a branch of the Inquisition. Again, part of the sort of Protestant mythology of the founding of the Netherlands is based on the threat of the Inquisition, but of course the Spanish Inquisition was never instituted in the Netherlands. Paul III established the Roman Inquisition in 1542 as part of his reform efforts, later reorganized as the Congregation of the Faith, though it varied significantly to the Spanish institution in organization and severity, dealing mostly with heresy within the Papal States and of course witchcraft. When the Theatine Calafa, Paul IV, became Pope in 1555, the scope of the Inquisition was intensified. Fleeing Spain and war in Germany, Protestants and Muranos came to Rome, to which Paul responded with the bull Cum Nihibus Absodum, which established the Roman Jewish ghetto. He even attempted to introduce the Spanish Inquisition into Lombardy through Philip II, though such measures were checked by Charles Borromeo, one of the principal reformers and saints, and essentially one of the saints of the Tridentine period from Milan. And another little note of historical irony, being that Isabella and Ferdinand, their most Catholic majesties, who patronized Rodrigo Borgia, the Catalan Pope, attempted to again entice him to create a Roman Inquisition, and he failed at the urging of the Spanish monarchs. In this instance, we have a Pope urging a Spanish monarch to begin a Inquisition. So things have really changed here. Paul IV was also responsible for introducing the Index Librorum Prohibitorum, the banned book list, which graded the heretical severity of various works, a response not only to heresy, but to the innovations in printing and works proliferating in the vernacular. And those are two really important things. Why do we have the banned books list arriving during the pontificate of Paul IV? Is not just owing to his severity, but it's also owing to the fact that over the previous 100 years from the foundation of the Gutenberg press, we are seeing a proliferation of written information on an unprecedented scale and translated into the vernacular, when previously, and this is sort of the last sort of legacy of humanism, all major sort of academic theological works were produced in Latin, meaning there was an inherent elitism to all of them. The original 1516 list compiled under Paul was severe and included the complete works of Erasmus, one of the great Flemish humanist philosophers, though later editions were relatively relaxed. This is consistent with trends already established in art, and it should be noted that this list existed all the way up to, and again, one of the legacies of Vatican II. Again, with so many things with Vatican II, Vatican II argues that technically there should be some religious censorship. There should be some censure of obscene material, yet at the same time we see the abolition of the index. So the theology is there, you're simply taking away the teeth. Copernicus, whose work was dedicated to Paul III in 1543, was added to the index over 70 years later. And again, this really should be noted in terms that this persecution didn't all come at once. And we see the astrological sort of pushback really comes in the early 17th century. Again, 70 years after the creation of the Roman Inquisition, now the Congregation of the Faith. Polymath Giordano Bruno, a friar and an occultist, and the author of The Art of Memory, began to advocate for Copernican cosmology, but more so he became a pantheist. And what I mean by that, he didn't become a polytheist. I believe he became completely enamored in the idea of infinity, completely rejecting the Catholic conception of God, rejecting the idea of the Trinity. In addition to that, he advocated for a Pythagorean concept called metempsychosis, which is a form of reincarnation. And for all of this, he was subsequently burned to the stake for heresy. Tommaso Campanella represents an interesting case in that he was a Dominican friar, a Thomist, taking Tommaso in honor of Thomas Aquinas. And yet he would later go on to repudiate Aristotle, whom Aquinas had essentially synthesized into Catholic doctrine, and was now denounced by the congregation rather than the Roman Inquisition. He was released, and then he was later imprisoned in Naples due to his alleged role in a conspiracy to topple Spanish rule in Calabria, one of the poorest provinces in Italy. And it is in prison where he penned most of his works, including The City of the Sun, which is going to be reading for the discussion next week. And during this time, I think it was in 1521, he also wrote a defense of Galileo, which also, you know, heaped scorn on the congregation. He was then, interestingly enough, released due to the personal intercession of Pope Urban VIII and the King of Spain, only to flee from Naples again after one of his supporters was involved in yet another, as John Boy is saying, Cantabria, no, Calabria. Calabria is the toe of Spain, essentially, just next to Sicily, not Cantabria. So what does this, and of course, you know, the end of Campanella's life is that he is received by Louis the 13th of France as an honored guest, and he dies in Paris. And so what is ultimately Campanella in the scheme? Campanella was a heterodox Catholic, and interestingly enough, Ghibelline, and a supporter of universal monarchy, trying to tie this back into the beginning of this conversation, which stemmed from the lecture discussion on Charles V. Galileo, of course, later revised Copernicus and later published the dialogue concerning the two chief world systems in Italian. And this was seen as an attack on then Pope Urban VIII. Up until this point, Galileo had received support from his Tuscan patron, the Grand Duke, and the Jesuits. Before the Inquisition, he was forced to recant, and his dialogue was placed on the index. And again, in terms of emphasizing this, is the fact that his work was seen as a challenge directly on papal authority, and the fact that he was publishing this work in the vernacular. And the interpretation of the Inquisition, essentially, was that he was using this, the Copernican system, the challenging of the idea that the Earth was the center of the universe, rather it was the sun that was the center of the universe. Challenging the traditional mythology and theology wasn't the reason. I mean, he was essentially he was rebuffed by the church for it. The church didn't accept his ideas, and this in many ways prompted his dialogue concerning the two chief world systems. But it's the fact he decided to publish this work in Italian, and it was interpreted as an attack on the Pope, which caused the rather severe reaction, the severe reaction, which actually placed him under a house arrest for the rest of his life. Now, coming to some sort of conclusion, I have a little quote here from Thomas Walsh on Philip II. The Catholic Church, after more than a century of effort by the best and wisest of her members, and of the obstruction by enemies without and within, once more renewed herself and entered upon her modern phase, a phase in which, time after time, she would choose principle rather than numbers, In the Council of Trent, she let it be known that even if all but a handful deserted her, she could not be false to the teachings and the example of Christ. And this is very interesting for, you know, multiple reasons, because I brought up in my lecture on Charles V my comparison to Charles V with the Emperor Heraclius, who, of course, had convened an ecumenical council to deal with the Monophysite controversy, a heresy, which had affected most of Egypt and parts of Lower Syria at the time. And for the sake of unity, the ecumenical patriarch, along with the Emperor Heraclius, essentially convened a compromise form of faith. And my contention essentially was that had Charles V been in a better position, and had the Council of Trent, as it occurred, not happened, it is very possible that we could have seen some form of compromise theological doctrine trying to bridge the gap between Protestantism and Catholicism. Interestingly enough, the Protestant derision and hatred of the Pope served Charles's own interests if he was to adopt this Ghibelline conciliarist conception, which de-emphasized the Pope as the supreme theological head of Christendom. The, you know, going back to Bonifacio VIII and Innocent III, the idea that the Pope is a temporal and spiritual leader of all of Christendom. Nevertheless, this isn't the case. And what actually happens is, remarkably, from the point of view of the very lowly prospects of the papacy in 1530, Paul III is able to significantly restore the fortunes of the papacy. And then we get to the great pontificates of Pius V. And Sixtus V, the new sort of reformed, one could say bellicose, confident Catholicism, which has committed to reform, but reform of the church, not reform by dismantling the church, as was the case with the Protestant Revolution. So we're faced essentially with the question of a smaller church, which is orthodox, versus the idea of unity. And again, I can't help leaving this on a rather controversial note, but ponder whether this is the fundamental schism between Benedict XVI and his idea, essentially, of having a smaller church which will be stronger, or the concept of Francis, which is anti-rigidity and fraternity, whatever that means. But I'll leave you with that and then get on to the question. So, alas, the lecture is over, and any questions? I'll just look over super chats whilst I expect to have a flurry of questions, and I can answer them all because I am here. I am captive to my audience. So, go on. Any questions, anyone? I'm just refreshing the super chats now. Terry Steely has given me £10. Thank you very much, but he has said nothing. There is no question. So thank you very much, Terry Steely. But do send a question when you send a super chat. Thank you very much. John Boy for €10. AM, please do not credit me with any intelligence. I'm a miserable sinner. Right. I'm not sure quite what that that's in reference to. But I don't know how intelligent you are, John Boy. You're watching this channel, so, and you're contributing to it. So I'm very much honored and grateful. And maybe that's a credit to your intelligence. I don't know. But thank you, John Boy. Right. Merrimack. Hi, AM. What were the effects of the Council of Trent taking place in Trent specifically? That's quite interesting. I don't actually know specifically. I do know that when, obviously, Trent was chosen because it was considered to be essentially a safe location. This is taking place within the height of the Italian Wars, the conflict between the House of Valois and the Burgundian House of Habsburg. And Trent was essentially considered neutral soil. What was remarkable was that the attack by the Saxons, the Protestant elector Maurice is an interesting character in the fact that he was actually essentially placed on the elector's throne in Saxony after Charles V's victory in the War of the Schmalkaldic League. And of course, then Maurice becomes the central instrument of Charles's downfall, his essentially forced acceptance of the Peace of Augsburg in 1555, and ultimately his abdication. But during the would-be attack, when Maurice was in the Tyrol and Charles V was in flight, the council, I believe, was moved to Bologna. And of course, Bologna being one of the great intellectual centers in Italy, one of the most wealthy advanced cities. But of course, Bologna recently had been incorporated back into the Papal States. Right. Any other questions? Okay, I'm going to go through with the shilling, because that's the only question I received. Thank you very much, Merrimack, for putting forward a question. Come on, everyone. I've been speaking for over an hour and 15 minutes. I'm sure there is one question. I presented some very controversial points in this lecture, I'm sure. Right. Okay. Anyway, moving on. I want to thank all my wonderful patrons again for making all of this work possible, and for me to dedicate extra time and buy extra books. So thank you very much. You can contribute to this channel over on Subscribestar or by becoming a member on YouTube. So thank you very much. There is also another point I want to make, which is I've set up a Discord server, which is linked in the description. And essentially, this is to foster more engagement with the subjects and the channel in general. And of course, there is a dedicated channel to this series, Nations of Charlemagne. If there are any more points or questions you want to bring up off stream, I do promise to check in as regularly as I can on that Discord server. So please join. Other than that, I see we've got a couple more questions. Okay, Terry Steele again. Thank you very much. I appreciate your work, AM. That's all. Thank you very much. What are your thoughts on the Vicar of Christ being technically translatable into Greek as Antichristos, the Antichrist? Oh dear, that subversive cringe walker. I seem to have inherited you from Academic Agents channel, haven't I? I've also seen you pop up in the Discord. I think you know what my thoughts are on that. The interesting thing is, what was I going to say? I was going to bring up some obscure link with the Russian Tsardom and the conception of the Tsar. I don't think it's really relevant. But in terms of the actual Greek translations, I don't read ancient Greek. I don't have a version of the Koine Greek Bible. I do have a copy of the old Vulgate and the Nova Vulgata. But nevertheless, I will look into it, but I think it's pretty clear from my theological inclinations and my severe orthodoxy when it comes to Catholicism that that isn't something I really indulge in. And of course, you know, it's very convenient for the Lutherans such as yourself. Right. Polish ambassador, why was Poland on that map, pink AM? Which map? This map. Is there anything wrong with being pink? I mean, I don't like any of the color schemes on this map, really. I think it's a disgusting map. It's also inaccurate. Florence is not Florence at this time, it's Tuscany. Right. Maybe only some popes are. Maybe. Anyway, so what have I done? Yes, very important to shill on Monday. There is going to be the adjoining stream for this conversation, so please join us for that conversation. Other than that, thank you all very much for watching. Please tune in on Monday for the next conversation. And what else? This lecture series, of course, is going to continue next week with the 30 Years' War. Thank you very much, everyone, and good night.